Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Welcome back to Excuse Me, May I Have Some More? We are the Foodcast with an Insatiable Appetite. My name is Brad Kramer. I am joined by my co-host, as always, Christine Struble. Hey, Christine.
Hi, Brad. How's it going?
It's been a couple of weeks since we've done one of these. Your frenetic schedule as the grand poobah of foodcited.com and me simply as the co-host and waiting for you to come up for air. We have a lot to catch up on, but we don't have a lot of time to do it. We have a really interesting episode this week. I would best describe it as thoughtful and thought-provoking, more serious in tone as far as subject matter. And we'll discuss that in a little while. But just as a tease, our two guests this week are what I call restaurant royalty in this country. Alice Waters, the owner of Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, and Jose Andres, a chef with quite a few restaurants around the country. And we'll talk a little bit more about them. But before we pivot into the serious, I have the memory and maybe the physique of an elephant. And you left us hanging with a story that you told me you were going to share on the next episode, and I made a note and wanted to have you actually share that story. Even though we're now into November and October was National Pork Month, when we talked about pork on our last episode, you said you had a story or stories to share about pork and a Polish chef.
Yes. So many, many years ago in Chicago, the Polish Pork Board hosted a luncheon.
Say that three times fast.
Exactly. It was porktastic. They had this special luncheon where
don't hog the airtime here.
We're gonna go everywhere with bad. So two chefs came over to Chicago and cooked a pork-centric multi-course lunch for us, and they didn't give us a menu ahead of time. They just said, it's going to be all pork, served various ways. Enjoy. And what they didn't quite inform us ahead of time is that one of the chefs quite enjoyed his Polish vodka. So after every course, we were encouraged to have another shot, and which was probably the best because once they revealed the menu, it was very much a nose-to-tail experience. Everything from, you know, simple things like pork belly, which you expected, to there was aspic, was a lovely gelée. There was
a meal that isn't complete until you've added something gelatinous to it.
Oh, it was there was a terrine, so layers of gelatinous. Oh. Then what was one of the other ones? It wasn't tongue because that's normally tough. There was another piece of another course that involved offal, but they didn't tell us. And when you ate it, you know, at the time, everyone thought it was just like a pork loin. So we went through the whole gamut, and then they gave us the menu as we left, and you know, you're feeling really good after having a few, you know, cocktails. So
as you do.
But it was one of the things where you kind of sat back and went, you know what, when I would sit at a table or someone handed me a menu and they gave me a name of a dish and said X, and it read of, you know, sweetbreads and this and the stomach lining of blah, 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 blah. Most people would be like, oh my God, no, this is disgusting. You can't, you know, there's no way I'm ever going to eat it.
And Christine then, instead was probably like a pig in slop.
Well, I mean, yes, if I'm going to have my choice of give me a really great filet and something else that's maybe not, I'm going to pick the filet. I'm not stupid. But, you know, if you don't know what it is and you're just, okay, take a bite and it looks gorgeous, you know, very appetizing. And then it tastes good, even if it jiggles. You kind of go, oh, you know, maybe we don't need the label on it. Maybe there is something to be said for that. Go into a restaurant and let the chef just guide you by the hand, take you by the hand and guide you through the experience and go with it and not, you know, have a preconceived notion.
No, first of all, if I'm going to have something at my dinner table or with my meal that jiggles, it's going to come out of a box with the word Jell-O on it.
J-E-L-L-O. Watch that wobble, see that wiggle, taste that jiggle. Jell-O brand gelatin of all desserts. You'll love the one that moves and shakes and makes such fun. Make Jell-O gelatin and make some fun.
Not something that was created from somewhere between the vicinity of the nose and the tail of a large mammal.
Okay, so should we go into the fact of what, how is gelatin made?
It's from marrow and like bones, and isn't it?
I cartilage.
Okay, so I was close.
Yeah.
Okay. Whatever.
But still, if you think
we won't
about
get, we won't be getting that Jell-O sponsorship now as a result.
Everything's better with Jell-O.
Everything's also better with Bluebonnet on it.
Ooh, there you go.
Yeah, I've just aged myself.
It's the only margarine double blended for creamy, buttery taste. No wonder more homemakers use Bluebonnet than any other margarine.
Corn tastes better. Everything's better with Bluebonnet on it. Buttery.
I spoke recently to legendary restaurateur Alice Waters, who 50 years ago this year opened Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. She is considered the mother of the one of the founders of the organic and slow food movement. She even released a book earlier this year called We Are What We Eat, a Slow Food Manifesto. And so I had a chance of talking to had the chance to talk to her about slow food and organic food and the origins of Chez Panisse and 50 years of Chez Panisse and her very exciting edible schoolyard project that she launched 25 years ago through her Chez Panisse Foundation. She was very generous with her time and a very interesting woman to talk to and learn from. Unfortunately, I have not had the pleasure of ever dining at Chez Panisse, and I was just curious if you have.
No, I haven't. When I lived in California during law school, that wasn't exactly in my budget.
Okay. I was hoping that you'd say, oh yeah, you had the opportunity once. And then they're opening an LA location in very short order. And I've gotten to Los Angeles far more than I've gotten to the Bay Area. So I'm like, well, that would be on my food bucket list to be able to experience Chez Panisse. That said, chatting with her about slow food and organic food and what was truly her a farm to table philosophy from day one. Do you have any thoughts, feelings about that and the how it's evolved and become far more prominent? You talked to Wolfgang Puck earlier this year, who used to drive from Beverly Hills down to Rancho Santa Fe. in Southern California outside of San Diego, just because he had found a farm there to provide him with the fresh produce and the fresh fruits and everything, vegetables that he wanted for his restaurant. It's become forefront in the food world and restaurants and food service and such. And she's trying to bring it into schools as well through the Edible Schoolyard program. You've been doing this for a while as far as food writing and whatever. Have you noticed that uptick in awareness on slow food, organic food, and that whole farm to table?
I think it's something that's always been around, but now it's more, diners are more aware of it because a lot of chefs are even putting it on their menu. I mean, if you look at many popular restaurants across the board, it's not just the vegetables and herbs that are say, they'll say like, oh, this is featured from, like Rick Bayless always says, this is from Three Sisters Farm in the Midwest, or, you know, some chefs now are saying, oh, this pork is from XYZ farm in wherever, which, you know, so that type of acknowledgement that it's important. And that's part of the reason why the flavor of the dish, it is different than what you're going to necessarily find at your grocery store, I think is part of the conversation at the table. It also can spark the home cook to be more aware that there is a benefit to not only supporting the local farmer from a business perspective, because they are hurting, but also from the food perspective of eating local, eating fresh is much, has a very different component than another, just opening a box and reheating in the oven. You know, there's anyone who's traveled throughout the world appreciates the way of eating in other countries is far different than what we see in a lot of places in the United States, just because they shop every day at the local farmer's market, or the, you know, pop-up that happens across the street. You only purchase so much food for a day or two. You don't go to the local warehouse and fill the back of your SUV to the brim and stack things high in your pantry. Just, that's just not the way it is. So bringing it into the conversation and making it very apparent, I think that's the bigger trend, not necessarily incorporating it into a dish or a menu. It's always been there. It's just people are more aware of it now.
And that's one of the fascinating things that I learned in talking to Alice. If since the beginning, for 50 years now, each menu item lists the farm that the food was sourced from, which I find interesting in of itself. But also, she went on to tell me, as you'll hear, that Chez Panisse does not have recipes, and they source their daily supplies and produce and vegetables and, you know, fish, whatever, and then sit down and brainstorm how to best bring those ingredients to life, make the tastiest, most appealing dishes, as opposed to just saying, okay, we have watercress today. Let's pull the watercress recipe out of our toolbox. So I found that to be very interesting. And instead of me sitting here and trying to recite verbatim those tidbits that she shared and the things I learned, let's take a listen ourselves. This is Alice Waters, the owner of Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. And once you are done listening to this interview, hopefully you will be compelled to seek out, whether it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or whatever, her new book, We Are What We Eat, A Slow Food Manifesto. Here's Alice Waters.
When you opened Chez Panisse in 1971, the country was in the middle of quite a bit of political turmoil. As you sit here today celebrating its 50th anniversary, we're now again mired in substantial political turmoil. I was hoping you could talk about your thoughts on feeding people and your approach to food during both periods, and if there's any similarities despite the time span.
Well, there really are many similarities. I was very shocked by what was going on in the 60s. I just was in the midst of the free speech movement at Berkeley and the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. We felt like we could change the world if we all got together and protested. And in fact, I've never lost my hope from that period of time. I really do feel like we could still get together and change the world. And I have great plans for it. Wow. But food is primary. Food is what we all do to survive. It's universal. And the other thing that's universal is education. Everybody goes to school, should. So I feel there's an extraordinary opportunity right now, and especially having experienced these couple of years in the pandemic and having the fast food industry exposed. We know what they're doing now, and we know it goes against the health of this nation. It goes against the values that we need to live on this planet together. And I think the most shocking part is to really understand that the agriculture that's happening in this country is causing climate change, causing it.
So I'm undereducated, but very interested. And I don't know if this ties into that, but your latest book, We Are What We Eat, you call it the Slow Food Manifesto. Does your definition of slow food and its vital importance to our lives, our environment, our society, and even our economic health tie back into what you just addressed?
Absolutely. Because slow food is really about winning people over, understanding that food needs to be good, clean, and fair. And that there's a way that we can connect with people at the table and teach these values through taste, through camaraderie, through a very determined way that we purchase food. We can make something happen that is good for the planet and good for our health, and especially supporting the people who take care of the land and farm workers for the future of this planet.
So I know there's not a one or two sentence answer to that, but how do we, how do we, in a nutshell, accomplish that?
Well, I've thought about it a great deal over these 50 years. And I know one thing for sure, because of the Edible Schoolyard Project.
Which I was just about to ask you about. Okay.
We've been working at a school that has some kids, and they speak 22 different languages at home. And these are kids that have been involved in a project called the Edible Schoolyard. And what we're doing is we are teaching all of the academic subjects in a classroom in the garden and a classroom that's a kitchen. Okay. And so what is happening is they are learning with all of their senses engaged. And our senses are our pathways into our minds. And when we aren't touching and tasting and smelling and looking carefully and listening, we are not really experiencing life fully. So this is the philosophy of Maria Montessori that I learned when I took her training in London in 1968. And I've never, ever forgotten. I like to think that we are communicating a set of values that everyone personalizes in his or her school. And that's what's amazing about it, that these are human values that we all share. We do. They're human values. So I feel like if we did this in the public schools in this country, if we decided that we were going to cure all of our food from local regenerative organic farms and ranches that are close by, just imagine what would happen. Because it is that relationship of the school with the farms that right. brings the values right through the cafeteria door. And it's what happened at Chevenix. In the beginning, we connected with a farmer, Bob Kennard, and we were willing to pay him the real cost of food, not a wholesale price, the real cost.
Right.
And so he wanted to sell to us, and then he wanted all of our scraps, everything, to be brought back to him so he could make compost, and he could farm his regenerative way, which is where all the nutrition is. It's in the soil. It's not in the supermarket
right.
and in the vegetables. It is in the soil. And I think we need to understand that it's that soil that's pulling down the carbon and addressing climate change. So can you imagine that there's something we could do in every school in this country that is addressing health profoundly, that it's pulling down the carbon into the ground, that it could be feeding children for free in school, it could be bringing these values to them. And guess what? It tastes really good because it's food that is ripe and in season.
So you're given credit for being the originator of that organic movement. And if not, and if you don't want to take credit for that, at least shining a light on it through your passion and through Chez Panisse starting 50 years ago. Do those roots, pun intended, begin with you, or is there an unknown pre-story that you alluded to that 60, 70 years ago that influenced you and moved you and made you, and increased your awareness?
Absolutely. Going to Paris changed my life.
Okay.
I went there when I was 19 and I experienced a slow food culture. I mean, what I ate in Paris in 1965 was food that was only local and seasonal and organic. And I didn't know that, but I tasted it.
Right.
And I said, when I got back from Paris, I want to eat like the French. So I was looking for taste, not really for values. I mean, I read Silent Spring and Diet for a Small Planet. I knew living in Berkeley, you just absorb that osmosis.
Right.
But in fact, In fact, I didn't know until I came to the doorsteps of the organic movement looking for taste that that's where it was. And then I wanted to shout it out. So we started putting the names of the farms on the menu. And then people would start asking, well, when are Masamoto peaches coming? You know, and it was that and my obsession with the farmers market that made me know that what people were experiencing at Chez Panisse was not necessarily about our cooking. It was about the farmers and the ranchers and the fishermen who were growing and raising those animals. It was that that gave a unique taste to the food at the restaurant.
Which and in essence all, made you the interpreter.
Yes. And you know, what we're talking about is the way that food has been grown and eaten since the beginning of civilization. I mean, maybe you got spices that were evolved along the Silk Road. Maybe you did get that. And maybe you got the special treat of chocolate or maybe citrus, at Christmas. But we always thought about winter as eating differently and summer food. I grew up in New Jersey, so I certainly know what that was about and really know what it's about because my mother was not a good cook.
Ah, okay.
And I looked forward to that corn and those tomatoes in the summer.
Chez Panisse remains closed due to the pandemic. And obviously the entire industry has been affected. If you peek into your crystal ball, which has been a pretty prolific crystal ball over the last 50 or 60 years, what do you see when looking ahead for Chez Panisse and for the industry as a whole?
Well, I'm very hopeful about restaurants around the country and around the world. We have been communicating with each other a lot and sharing all of our ideas. But I know that our future is local. And I say regenerative organic because regenerative really means that we're actively creating soil that is full of good things and it's pulling down that carbon. But I think that during this time, we've all learned how important our little restaurant communities are, how we run our business has become extremely important. People want to stay, thank goodness, at Chez Panisse, and that we want to take care of each other. Now, that has not been the case in most restaurants, and certainly in fast food restaurants, where they're run in a very corporate way, with the chef at the top and all of these workers at the bottom who aren't paid very much. And it's why, of course, fast food is so cheap.
Right.
But we know how important our employees are. We're collaborating with everybody to make a restaurant work. And that includes the dishwashers.
Right.
They're invaluable. We couldn't run the restaurant without them. and they need to have a nice place to work. They need to be paid well. They need to be connected with the mission of the restaurant. And I talk about that all the time, the fact that we don't want to have a back of the house
right. That
is unsightly and people doing work in places that we don't want to look. So I invite everybody into the kitchen and to the back room. And it's all part of feeling that it takes a village. I really believe that to run a successful restaurant, it takes everybody's participation. I wanted to have a little French restaurant,
right,
like the ones I ate in Paris, where they were run by a family. You know, had a small dining room, everybody ate the same food.
Right.
There was sort of a fixed price menu. And I think that's one of the ideas that has been very important to the longevity of the restaurant. Because every day we do a new meal.
Right.
And we don't have recipes. So we're sort of coming to it, as the Buddhists would say, with beginner's mind. We're right there. We're looking at the vegetables. What is the best thing to do with them? We have a framework of a menu,
right. But
we don't know until that day. And so it becomes this very important collaboration. Who wants to cook this on the grill? Who has an idea for the sauce, for the fish?
Right.
Who would like to make the salad today? It's that keeps us all inspired, and it's endlessly changing, and it's a place for interns to come and they can learn, and they have all these different points of view. You know, we have two chefs for every one position. So head chefs work 3 days, but they're paid for 5. And what that does is keeps everyone inspired, I think, to eat in other restaurants, to look in cookbooks, to have time with their families, to come in refreshed.
Right.
And it really helps for the people who work with them, because there's all of these different ideas. Not just one, but sort of 6 ideas from very experienced cooks.
And that sort of runs counter to what people imagine the restaurant industry to be and imagine each restaurant's product and menu to be. You're embracing your chefs and your cooks being informed by other restaurants and other restaurateurs and other cooks and chefs. You're casting a wide net and welcoming it with open arms.
Yes. I have to say yes.
Okay.
I'm always find out something by eating in other people's restaurants. And it keeps me excited about the work that I'm doing. And even though I'm not cooking at the restaurant, I'm always tasting.
Right.
I'm always giving feedback. Even in these difficult times when I'm so appreciative of everything that comes from Chez Panisse, but I know that my job is to give the cooks my feedback, and they welcome it, or I hope they do. They say they do.
So bringing us full circle, the fact that you're celebrating 50 years in Berkeley at Chez Panisse this year, you're now looking to open a new location in fairly short order, I imagine, in Los Angeles. What compelled you to finally head south, and how will the LA location of Chez Panisse differ from Berkeley's, if at all?
Well, it differs completely. because first of all, it's not another Chez Panisse. It's not. I have been involved with projects around the world. I helped to change the food at the American Academy in Rome. But I said, I would love to do this and to help to cheerlead for it. But I have to find a wonderful cook and somebody who can run the dining room. And that is a way that I can be involved. And that is the same idea at the restaurant in Los Angeles. It is connected to the University of California, and it's inside the Hammer Museum.
Right.
I've always wanted to be connected to the beauty of art. I've wanted to talk about food in relationship to art and to local regenerative organic food. I love the idea of having students come and work in the kitchens. And David Tanis worked at Chez Panisse, and he's a great teacher. And he was really wanting to change from the East Coast to the West Coast. So I caught him at a good time. But also Jesse McBride is somebody who is the child of someone I knew as a filmmaker back in the 60s, Jim McBride. And so he was somebody that I wanted to be involved with this project. He had worked in many restaurants around Los Angeles. And he was somebody that I liked very much and almost worked as the general manager at Chez Panisse one time. So I knew that he shared the values and that he would know LA and he would know who to bring into the restaurant.
Right.
And then I have a lot of artists who are friends in LA, and one of them is Christina Kim. And she has brought all kinds of amazing people to help us figure out how to recycle everything, how to think about creating a space that contains the values that are embedded in the food.
And we're back. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Alice Waters. If you did and you are compelled, next time you're in the Bay Area or in Los Angeles, be sure to make a reservation and visit Chez Panisse and pick up her book. And just make sure you experience the work and the creativity and the delicious food of one of the people that, again, I refer to as restaurant royalty. And speaking of more restaurant royalty, Christine, you just talked recently to Chef Jose Andres, who, if anybody is unfamiliar, especially foodies that might be listening to this foodcast, his organization, World Central Kitchen, that he and Nate Mook run, is just an amazing organization that, whether it's a hurricane or a power outage or any disaster that hits an area, a geographic area, whether it's in Haiti or New Orleans or wildfires out west, and people are without food or need food resources, Jose Andres's team at World Central Kitchen swoops in and does amazing work, yeoman's work. And if there were a time man of the year that was apolitical or a time woman of the year that was apolitical, I think Jose Andres would be a slam dunk. Before we aired the Alice Waters interview, you referenced food waste, and your conversation with Jose Andres was in conjunction with a partnership he is enjoying with Hellman's Mayonnaise, focusing on the issue of food waste. And in your conversation, he chuckled a couple times and I smiled and enjoyed a phrase that he used called fridge hunting. So Before we share that conversation with people, I was hoping you would expound a little bit upon the food waste conversation and the fridge hunting.
Well, it's a simple idea, fridge hunting, just to kind of discover those food items that have been pushed way in the back of the refrigerator that are often forgotten, that you have to pull out from the dark dank crevices and appreciate what is left in the house, that things that can be used that aren't just a one-time meal that all of a sudden, once it leaves the table, is put in the refrigerator, forgotten until you go through your weekly clear out to be thrown away in the trash. You know, it's when you think about other societies or other groups, they don't go and do these gigantic shops for the week where you buy large amounts of food and then sometimes forget about what you've purchased. And while the shelves of the refrigerator seem to be overflowing, I think we've all been to the point where you open the door and you go, there's nothing to eat. And it's time to be a little more thoughtful, that just because you have tomatoes in your salad at dinner and everyone doesn't finish that dish, you don't just automatically throw it in the trash. You keep that tomato water and you use it as a dressing for another salad or a pasta dish, or as the base of a soup. This concept of one and done, I think, is starting to go away, even more so with people being maybe even a little more frugal with their food purchases, that they need to appreciate the multi-purposes of the food that they buy. So this is something that Chef has been doing for most of his life. It's something that his children know well. Hopefully more families can start adopting that concept, so that, you know, that one piece of chicken that you serve Sunday night at dinner can turn into a salad the next day or a soup another day, and just kind of keep food out of the trash, as opposed, you know, keeps money in your wallet too. It's got to be, you know, everyone knows cost prices are going up for food right now. So being a little more thoughtful is not necessarily a bad thing.
And he shares some resourceful and entertaining ways of doing that, and talks about how he's done so in his own house now with his kids, and then growing up in a family that had food on the table, was not wanting for food, was a middle-class family, but still it was very important that every ounce of food that was left around was repurposed, utilized, and incorporated into another meal. And I thought that was fascinating the way he shares it. But instead of you and I trying to describe that, let's hear in his own words as he talks to you about this new partnership with Hellman's Mayonnaise. This is Chef Jose Andres talking to Christine Struble.
A couple questions. And I know you have been very vocal about food waste over many, many years. And, you know, looking at some of the stats that they provided as part of this campaign, from the 40% of food waste happening at home to, you know, other facts that we know that food waste is, you know, one of the largest components in a landfill. Do you think that for the home cook, is it really an issue of not understanding how to repurpose the food in the refrigerator? Or does it really start at the consumption level when they're at the store, and maybe the problem of overbuying what they choose to put in the refrigerator?
Obviously, it's all of the above, right? Listen, I remember when I was younger and I would go to the shop every single day with my mom or my dad, and we will buy the bread for the morning for that day. And we will buy the fish the day we will eat fish. And we will buy the chicken the day we will eat chicken. And we will buy fruit and vegetables every 1 or 2 days or twice a week. Usually in my house, Saturday will be the big day of vegetables and fruits. But things have changed. Everybody is busier. Everybody works. Everybody spends maybe too much time driving. Now we go once every 2 weeks to the big supermarket and we fill up the car to the very top. And if not, we are ordering online. That when you order online, sometimes you even forget what you order. And you have a tendency to over. So it's all of them. So obviously, we'll be very smart to understand that sometimes less is more. Because if not, you are more trying to be fighting against when the food is about to go garbage because it's rotten, versus trying to enjoy yourself and cook what you really want to be eating. But I think this campaign of fridge, obviously of fridge hunting, precisely sending a very simple message that overall I see the vast majority of Americans really care about food. I would say everybody loves food. We have an attachment. We know how to cook, but we don't. We all have food stories. We all have food memories. Food is who we are. Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you who you are. So just for Americans to see that we can be part of something bigger, that we don't have to be reminding them every day, all of us, that there's hunger in America, there's hunger in the world. There is food waste in America, there's food waste in the world. But still everybody wants to do something. Well, by donating to philanthropy, well, by donating time, local churches, synagogues, or NGOs like Once in the Kitchen. Everybody wants to be part of something bigger than themselves. This is a very simple way that you can feel like you are part of a bigger group of we the people, where the challenge is simple. Can we save a million meals with these Hellman's mayonnaise idea that I love, they invite me to be part of, by just doing something that fridge hunting you can do with your children. You can get your phone and you can go, like if you were a Star Wars, flying through inside the refrigerator, doing a video recording, all those things that they are alone, that they are sitting forgotten, that they are saying, why you left me? Then they told me the other day in the bottom of the refrigerator, why you left me alone? I've been sad all these 10 days. And I think it's a very fun game used to on purposely, before you go shop next, to say, I'm going to use the last corner of this refrigerator, of this freezer, of whatever else you have in your pantry, the spices even you never use in your life, and they are there sitting waiting for you to say hello. I think this is the right moment to do it, coming out of this crazy pandemic we've all lived, where every dollar is going to count. It's a lot of working families. Like I remember my mom, that she was a working family. I was in a middle class working family. Both were nurses. We money was not, food was not an issue in my house. But my father and mother would have to look for the last peseta, the last dollar, the last euro towards the end of the month until the next paycheck. Is when my mom will show up with the best dishes. The croquetas were leftover dishes, that the bechamel and the ham and the cheese and the chicken leftover pieces will go into it. She'll run it with the breadcrumbs of the same bread that she kept, and she will use the coffee grinder to make the breadcrumbs. Nothing will go to waste. And those croquetas were sensational. And she will be able to feed us with milk and flour and some leftovers without having to go to the supermarket. To me, I think that's something like we need to all work harder. You don't need to be a super chef to make something out of leftovers. You only need to have the willingness to open the fridge and to say, today we're going to make a fun day by fridge hunting, and we're going to do something amazing with it. And people are going to be amazed of how many meals they can be using only by having the willingness and using a little bit of the creativity that everybody has. Even the people that think they don't know how to cook, if they put a little bit of effort into it, everybody can be a great cook.
Well, you brought up a very interesting point that it seems that it comes from within. One individual can spark others to make a change. And in addition to that, it seems like it can be a family moment to get everyone going in. In some ways, I kind of look back at when I was little, it was mom, dad, don't throw your bottle out the window when you're littering. So now it's my kids going, Mom, you forgot that we had some apples in the refrigerator. What are we going to do with that tonight? Is that part of this campaign to make it a concerted effort to start within the home and then hopefully spark a conversation to everybody else?
Obviously, I know that beyond this campaign that goes directly to tell every American household, come on, join us. Let's save a million meals together. Hopefully, we're going to save many more, but let's try to aim for something like this, highly doable. I know beyond helmets, I know they've been very active in trying to support the United Nations development goals for the year of 2030. And food waste will be one of them, one of the corners of the many other things that have to happen. By fighting food waste, obviously, we do many more things, right? We can reduce the CO2 emissions by the number of trips you do to the supermarket, by the number of trips the trucks have to bring food from the farms to the supermarket. It's many indirect benefits of making sure that we minimize the amount of food that we waste. Obviously, the family economies are going to be every dollar you can be saving is a dollar you can be helping to pay your tuition, university, your medicines, a school, rent. I mean, come on, every dollar counts. My mom, I remember she said, today by eating croquetas is great. We're able to bring down the payment in the house. Like, okay, great. I don't care. Those croquetas are really beautiful. So consciously, unconsciously, the benefits of just trying to move this campaign forward that I think is brilliant. You know, Hellmann's didn't told me to join them, used to, hey, help us sell helmets. They asked me to join them to send the message that food waste actually should be cool and should not even be food waste. They are delicious foods that maybe that avocado looks a little bit dark right now. It's not the perfect green that you see in the perfect ad, in the perfect photo, the perfect guacamole, but that avocado is good. Don't throw it. Just go and make something with it. You don't like the way it looks? Hey, just put the avocado in the plate, cover it with mayo, with mayonnaise, put some sumac or some sesame seeds, put some salt on top, put a touch of olive oil around. If you have a little green salad there, put them there. Right there. You make the great avocado salad right there. You have three leftover potatoes that, because they were roasted or they were boiled and you didn't use them and you peel them and you mix them with the mayonnaise and you put some tuna that also was left in the can because somebody made a tuna sandwich, a tuna melt, and they didn't finish the entire can. And it's going to be thrrown garbage if somebody doesn't eat it within soon because it'll be forgotten. You put it there and you have a great tuna and potato salad with the mayonnaise. That is very typical tapa in Spain, but also we know it's a very typical beloved dish here in America. So you can be recreating an American dish or you can be recreating a Spanish dish. You change one ingredient here and there, and you can be in a different continent right in the fingertips in the process of using things that you are about to be thrown away if you don't do something with them. And I think that's a way that directly, indirectly, consciously or unconsciously, we all can be doing a lot of good and become part of a big team. The team that is going to say, food waste no more. Let's make sure that every bite counts, that every ingredient counts. And together, with very little effort, you can be part of something bigger than you, something much more global, that in the process, we are helping really not only save money, but controlling, creating a better world. One dish at a time, and you don't even need to think about it, but it's going to be happening. And that's the beauty about this.
And it seems like one of the biggest points of all of this is to embrace a little bit of creativity in the kitchen, to see beyond ingredients that are just for maybe one meal, and expand what you can do in a kitchen. So as we look at your recipes that you're going to be providing, do you think that those are just a starting point to the conversation for the home cook and giving them the tools to kind of keep pushing forward?
Yeah, I think this is going to be taken as maybe in the month to come and to many other. I mean, listen, Fridge Hunter should be used as a show, like Ghostbusters, but with you put two or three chefs in two or three cities across America, and you keep going, and you have a call, and people call you, and you show up, and you go into their fridge, and you give them tips about how to do it. This should be happening as we speak. But I think, obviously, cooking is one of these areas that even the people that say, I don't know how to cook, everybody can cook. When you open the can of mayonnaise, that simple thing of opening it, even if you didn't make it, is cooking itself. Going shopping is the beginning of cooking itself. I know it sounds strange, but if you grab an apple out of the orchard, you are beginning, that's cooking. Any act of doing something like this is going to be feeding somebody itself, it's cooking. So for me, I think if it's a moment that everybody can feel I'm creative, even when they feel they're not, that's cooking. And that's a very powerful thing and a very powerful moment. And quite frankly, I see in the kitchen is the place I always see the biggest happiness. Well, because the amazing things you do, or maybe because the terrible things you do and you laugh about them. We all cherish the moment of sharing time cooking with somebody else. Mm-hmm. And the dish is great, even the better. If the dish is not maybe everything you dream of, I'm sure it's still good because it's okay. You know, I always say if something is not as you thought, just change the name of the recipe and that's it. If you overcook and overboil the eggs and they are not over easy anymore, just change the name of the recipe. Overcook eggs my way, right? Because you want them more creamy, put a little bit of mayonnaise on top and bingo, you got all the creaminess you needed back into the eggs. So I think, yeah, I mean, quite frankly, when they approached me to do this at the beginning, I was like, what? But I began thinking about it. I talked with my daughters about it. I'm like, Daddy, that's what you do all the time. I get very upset when they throw me the little oil and vinegar and the water of the tomato of the salads, because that's like money cannot buy it. It's so good. It's the concentrated vinegar, the olive oil that got the water of the tomato. You eat this with the spoon, and he's like, oh my God. And we throw that guy. I mean, keep that in the refrigerator. This is a great leftover. And you're going to use it the day after for another vinaigrette, or I don't know, you're going to top it. You're going to use it for a soup, or you're going to top it. Use it whisk with eggs that, believe it or not, works. And you can make these more not so hard kind of omelette. It's so many things you can be doing. But me, I love this kind of leftovers, when you make a meal and you have two tablespoons of a little sauce in the bottom of the pan because you roasted peppers or the chicken that roasted, that all those juices that are left over there in the bottom of the pan and they gelatinize. Oh my God, I'm a freak for those because that's gold. You cannot buy it. That's a matter of how much money you have. That's unique. Me, I try always to encourage people that those are things that are precious and that we all need to learn how to use them in the days, because you are going to not only be using things that is going to help you fight food waste, but actually you're going to be eating some of the most delicious juices and sauces and dressings only by keeping them in a little container in your fridge.
Thank you for your time, Chef, and best of luck with the campaign and continued success with World Central Kitchen.
Thank you, Christine.
And we're back. I love that conversation you had with Jose Andres. And admittedly, sometimes the accent got a little thick for me. And I had the benefit of rewinding and listening again, because I was enjoying it so much and wanted to get the gist of what he was sharing with you. So if anybody listening to this foodcast also struggled a little bit with the accent, please do hit rewind a couple times and enjoy the interview. It's an important conversation. It's an interesting conversation. And he can always also be very humorous, as he was at times in the conversation with you. It's interesting. We have the benefit of talking to a wide variety of people for this foodcast and also for foodsided.com. And often humor comes into play, and I like to do my shtick and insert clips into these episodes and whatever. But sometimes it's important to do an episode like this, where we shine a spotlight on people like Alice Waters and Jose Andres, who are in the case of Jose Andres, not only a chef, but a humanitarian, and Alice Waters, who's working so hard to make sure that people are eating the right way and eating in a healthy way and maintaining the food cycle as it's meant to be. These are important conversations to share and to have. So it was, for me, it's a nice change.
Yeah. I mean, when we think about stuff, and it, you can fall into different route, different sides of the story. Yes. We all enjoy the funny notion of whether it's, you know, the absurdity of Salt Bae's $800 gold encrusted tomahawk steak, or do we really want to have a conversation of what's good, not only for the person, but also the planet, for our society? You know, there's a very unique situation when people sit around a table. It affords them the opportunity to be open and honest and speak their mind, because that plate of food in front of them removes the barrier. Whether it's talking about different cultures and backgrounds, or if it's talking about an issue that maybe is difficult to broach outside of that safe space, everything can kind of come out at the table. Now, hopefully, if there's a heated discussion, that, you know, animosity gets whisked away when the plates leave the table. But, you know, at least the conversation is had. So I think that's one of the nice things that, you know, being in the food world affords people, the ability to have conversations that maybe they wouldn't otherwise would.
That's stated very perfectly. I guess the core value of food in our world, at our table, in our families, in our households, whether at a restaurant or at home. So you sum that up pretty well.
Thank you. Every once in a while, say something that makes me sound quasi-intelligent.
There you go. With that, I want to thank everybody for listening to this episode of Excuse Me, May I Have Some More? We are the Foodcast with an Insatiable Appetite. Christine, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Brad, always a great conversation with you.
We'll do this again soon. Take care.
Bye, Brad.
Bye-bye. May I have some more?
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.